VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no,
I don't know, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel McCarthy, and I thank you for joining us. And I'm excited this week because making his return to the studio, it's Julien Laurens. And down the line from a special location somewhere in West London, just, what, a quarter mile from Matthew Syed's house, it's Matt Dickinson.
Hello.
Later on, we're going to be talking about the ugly scenes at the London Stadium that marred West Ham's defeat to Burnley. But we start at the Theatre of Dreams with one of the biggest fixtures in European football. Right, Dicko, I'm going to start with you because if you were to look at this game in a vacuum, it would be all about two of the most criticized players, I think, this year, Romelu Lukaku and Dejan Lovren. Lovren criticized because supposedly he's a bit wussy and he can't defend, and Lukaku being criticized for not scoring enough and being just too much of a front-to-goal striker. And on this occasion, Lukaku was big and physical and won the headers, and Lovren was monstered.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things where you see it and you see Lukaku do it and you think, why isn't he doing this all the time? I mean, there are games when we've all seen, you know, and notoriously some big games where he just seems to have sort of drifted through and you thought, hang on a minute, this guy's got so many attributes. Even if he's not playing great or not finishing great, surely he can sort of make himself involved, and the game seems to have drifted him by. But this was the opposite. And the surprise, I guess, was that having been done once for it, Liverpool got done again by almost exactly the same. I'm sure we'll get onto Lovren, but I think to single him out is, well, on the one hand, understandable given he was directly against him. On the other, it isn't just an isolated problem. I mean, there should be people covering. You know, if you can see that the goalie's going to punt it long, they're going for the flick, someone needs to be covering behind. Someone needs to be working out a strategy for the inevitable when you've got a player as fast as Rashford who's going for the flick on. So Lovren has a tough time, but, you know, why wasn't Van Dijk maybe taking over that responsibility? Why weren't others sweeping up behind? Why wasn't someone maybe trying to screen in front of Lukaku?
I want to touch upon that, Julien, because many, many years ago, young listeners, teams played with a sweeper. And you often had a guy who could actually play on the ball and pass, and sometimes he was fast, but would read the game well, and he would drop off, and the two center halves, and you would let the bigger, stronger center half pick up the bigger, stronger target man on the other team. I mean, hindsight's always 20/20, right? And maybe they would have beaten you in a different way, and I realize if you play a high line and you want to do the offside, it's difficult to move the guys around, and Lukaku doesn't stand still. But would that have been an option here? I mean, is this something Klopp maybe might want to look at?
It's weird that you don't react to it. Because once the first goal goes in and it's been working for them, you know that they're going to do it again. And you still don't adapt to it. And you still let Lovren 1v1 with Lukaku in the air, where he gets beaten every time. You don't have the protection from Chan. You don't have Van Dijk switching with Lovren maybe, or Van Dijk sweeping behind Lovren. You still don't have your fullbacks ready on their toes on the right side of the wide players, and you wonder, like, why haven't they tried to correct it? And then they get the second goal in a very similar way, and you're thinking, like, well, once you get punished, and yet you don't do anything about it, and then you get punished a second time, and it's really weird. I would have switched Van Dijk and Lovren straight away after that first goal.
But when you say switched, what do you mean? Just
on a goal kick from De Gea, knowing he's going to be long on Lukaku, and Lukaku on purpose targeting Lovren, because that was clearly the game plan. The game plan was if they'd wanted Lukaku on Van Dijk, De Gea would have kicked the ball on the 6-yard kick towards Lukaku, who'd have been on Van Dijk. So they clearly targeted Lovren because they knew Lukaku would bully him and monster him, as you put it in the script. So just for that, switch them, and it's, you know, it would have been different.
Dicko, a lot of people have given Jose Mourinho stick this year, and United, when you watch them play, like many different teams, it's kind of look pretty pedestrian and ordinary compared to Manchester City, and maybe it's his fault, maybe it's not his fault, but should we be giving him some credit here for tactically getting this right? And I'm not just talking about the long balls to Lovren, but also the way, especially in the first half, how I thought they were really effective at breaking Liverpool's press.
No, they looked what a Mourinho team, you know, has done most of his career, which is everyone knew exactly what their jobs were. I mean, you know, it does bring in the whole fascination of the Pogba situation, doesn't it? Because, I mean, this was a more classic Mourinho team with two sort of recognised physical holding players. And obviously we've had this big debate over the last few months about how Pogba fits in, where he fits in. Does he need to play wide in a three? This was back to, say, a more sort of classic, I thought, Mourinho setup. And the United looked better for that, which makes the Pogba debate in some ways even more fascinating. Helps when you know, for any manager, you suddenly throw Rashford back in. You know, I think as an English fan in World Cup year, who wasn't delighted to see that? I mean, I think a lot of us have felt frustrated that Rashford hasn't been getting games and slightly scratched our heads why. Maybe Mourinho, you know, just felt he'd gone off the boil, felt he needed a break. But, you know, having seen that, you assume now that he's going to get a proper run. When a manager rests the guy and brings him back in and he hits that sort of confidence and form, then he's going to say, look, I knew what I was doing all along, and it perfectly fitted, as I say, a sort of what felt like a Mourinho team that knew its jobs. And that's always the thing you've associated with Mourinho: players go out and know exactly what the plan is, what they're trying to do, and that certainly seemed to sort of go awry for quite a while.
Julian, this question is Pogba related and Sanchez related. I thought he was operating in a more central position, and I thought he did fine at that because he was busy, he was doing his defensive work. He didn't maybe get as many chances to break forward as you might have in a different game, but that's understandable because it's Liverpool and whatever. The problem is if you put Alexis there, because Mourinho's told us many, many times that Pogba's an eight and he's on the left of a three, and the numbers don't quite add up, because if I play Alexis behind the striker and then I have three midfielders, then what? I only have one guy on either side, and I can't play with, even Mourinho can't play with 12 players. Is there a broader message to this? And do you have any insight on the Pogba thing? Because obviously, again, he's out, and then there was that thing we saw Match of the Day where Mourinho's giving an interview and Pogba comes up and, like, you know, high fives him or whatever it was, you know, and they're all bros again. What's the deal?
The deal is he got a knock. McTominay, I think, actually sort of injured him. It's not a bad injury, but it was enough. It was bad enough for him not being really 100% fit and playing. And I think having played before this season in the league, not being 100% fit and got a lot of stick for
it. You need him for Seville.
Yeah, and you need it from Seville. And I think he might play in a two against Seville with Matic. That's the option. I think maybe...
Wait, but I thought we said you can't do that.
You can't do that. But if you decide to play in a 4-2-3-1 formation and you want to play him, that's the only position he can play if you play Sanchez behind the striker. I still think Pogba can do a good job behind Lukaku, and having that sort of free role in the midfield, if you want, with Matic and McTominay behind him, for example, or something. But that would mean Sanchez playing wide, either right or left. It's interesting. We see what he does in midweek, because I think this is obviously a huge game. And even next weekend in the FA Cup, it's a huge game as well against Brighton.
Dicko, as far as Klopp is concerned, there was all this goodwill. They're the best team to watch, blah, blah, blah. They'll finish second. It felt like they were all on a rise. And is this kind of deflating? Or maybe it shouldn't be deflating, because, I mean, losing at Old Trafford is not that big a deal, is it?
It's not a huge, but as you say, it stalls momentum that was properly gathering. You know, they're advancing on in Europe as well, and everything. You know, I think Liverpool fans thought they'd turned a significant corner. Yeah, they yet might. I mean, they're still on course to finish top four. Who knows how far they can go in the Champions League? You know, I guess one by one with Van Dijk will, you know, settle in and get better. The defence should keep improving. I think obviously the goalkeeper issue is one still to get on top of. I'm not sure Karius was sort of directly to blame for the second goal, but I sort of seem to be sort of lurching left and right and a bit all over the place. I still think, you know, there's clearly issues with that. But it's hardly a shock, is it, losing away at Old Trafford, you know, against a United team that hit their stride. But it's you know, I think one minute they're talking about second. I think now, if you could take top four, they would just you know, take it. I mean, they may yet come third, but I think they're in a decent place. You know, it's just the fact that they're not going to get the second place that I guess for a week or two they suddenly fancied.
Well, it's not a fact they won't get it. We still have games to play, right? I mean, negative Nelly there.
United,
right?
Look like, you know, I would say it would be a pleasant surprise for them, wouldn't it?
I want to touch upon something else, and I will reveal my bias here. I know Jamie Carragher, and I really like Jamie Carragher. So I've got my bias out there. I'm already biased here, just so you know. There was an incident afterwards which it's got a lot of play on social media. There's a video in a tabloid newspaper. Apparently Jamie Carragher was I guess driving home after the game, and he's on the motorway, and there's a car with a father and a son. A father and a daughter, actually, a 14-year-old daughter. And according to Carragher, sort of three or four times along the motorway, they drive close to him and they're making gestures at him. And I guess they're shouting out the window at him because they know it's Jamie Carragher and they're United fans and they're winding him up. At some point, Carragher comes to a stop. The car pulls up alongside him. They roll down the window and, you know, they're saying, they're still, you know, bantering about the 2-1. And Carragher spits out of his window. Now, the 14-year-old girl is in the seat by the open window, and the spit lands on her. And according to the story in the Mirror, she becomes very, very upset. Carragher has apologized profusely. He says there's no excuses. He says he was totally out of order, blah, blah, blah. Vinny Jones helpfully was on TalkSport saying that Carragher should be sacked. And I think we all agree that you shouldn't be spitting at other people. But I wonder, do you guys have any insight on how often this happens when you're, you know, a celebrity or a famous person associated with a team?
Yeah, I've seen it all the time. I've, you know, did Gary Neville's column for long enough and ghosted his book and sort of hung around with him enough public places to see that it can be blinking or not. You know, you can get pestered all the time, and that's pestered is the light version of it. It can get a lot worse than that if you end up in the wrong bar at the wrong time. But this wasn't a bar. This wasn't being monstered. This wasn't the Eddie Jones situation where you got a bunch of drunks, you know, screaming in your face. And, you know, if Eddie Jones had turned around and manhandled one, then could you have blamed him at this? The real disappointment about this, and, yeah, I know Jamie pretty well, and it ain't a clever way to react in any circumstance, but in a circumstance where it's just a bit of stick being thrown at you through a car window, then it's, it's totally out of order, isn't it?
I think it's disgusting. I don't know Jamie Carragher, so maybe I can speak more freely than you.
It is disgusting.
I agree. It's disgusting. There is no defence for it, absolutely.
He doesn't put up any defence. But by the same question, I just wonder about, you know, this guy who thinks that he's got public ownership of a public figure like Jamie Carragher that he thinks it's appropriate to go on a motorway to drive alongside him again.
On the video, what we can see is the dad only says, "All right, Jamie, lad, 2-1, lad," or something like that. There's no insult. There's no banter. There's nothing. And Carragher just spits out through his window. I mean, who does that? Then the same Jamie Carragher on Monday Night Football or on Sky is going to tell me and tell the players that he's watching how they should behave and what they should do, and, oh, they're doing that, that's wrong.
You know, when these people are off the clock in their private lives, that's who they are.
Yeah, okay.
Give me that. I seriously wonder about a guy who's with his kid, who presumably isn't drunk because he's driving, who thinks that this is appropriate behavior to go and chase after somebody. I mean,
he doesn't chase him. He's going home. He's in the car. It turns out that the car next to his could have been yours. It's Jamie Carragher's. They said to Jamie Carragher, "Oh, we beat you 2-1."
It happened 3 or 4 times, though.
Yeah, but that's what's going to happen. It's happening.
They're on the motorway. It's not like they stopped at a traffic light,
no,
right?
But it was this.
I mean, this is where Jamie has gone. I mean, the fact is, it doesn't, you know, mean that you just get thick skin to it forever. You know, people press your buttons at the wrong time. Sometimes we all react. But the fact is, Jamie's had a career of, you know, of so much worse than this.
Exactly.
You know,
all the players.
You go out in Liverpool, you're going to bump into an Everton fan. He's going to say, "Hey, remember?" You know, it's just that's something used to. And it's just that the surprise with this one is that it was so, whatever, you know, sticky's out as far as we can tell from the video, it seems so harmless. I mean, say if he had walked into the wrong bar in Manchester and is getting pelters and families being mentioned, then I'm not saying that makes a bit in right, but it puts it in a different context. This the context of this is where it seems so shocking, and I guess we're all, say, those of us who actually like him are so disappointed. I mean, I have actually written about this, so I don't think it's sort of gratuitous, but I once used it as illustration, actually, of praising him. He, on that trip to Malaysia, I mean, he was, this was when he was a teenager, England under-20s, and they were wild, that squad, and he was one of the wilder. This is Kieran Dyer featured this in his book recently, you know, when they as a squad, they all crapped in a carrier bag and stuck it on the coach's door. I mean, Jamie actually peed pretty much on my feet, urinating. I mean, it was bad scenes, and I've spoken to him about it since, and he's mortified and looks back and just goes, "God, what was I thinking?" And, you know, had matured, and, you know, he's made the best of himself, you know, done really well. He's a bright guy. He comes over well. You meet him. He's an interesting guy to speak to. And that's where, you know, I'm sort of, as soon as I saw this, I was a bit gutted, because he was a guy, I think, who had, you know, sort of made great strides in so many ways, and has become a really sort of admirable figure.
Now, this season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every single game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, and the FA Cup. And not just that, you also get our, what I think is exceptional content as well. It's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Now, Dicko, what was your favourite goal of the weekend in the Premier League?
I think it had to be Ashley Barnes, didn't it? I mean, one, just, you know, anyone who, the first time strike with curl on into the top corner, you're going to take. But if you can start a riot by scoring a goal, then hey, hats off. That's pretty impressive. So yeah, it's got to be that one for me.
Julien?
I went for Marcus Rashford's first goal. Because
little drag back.
Yeah, the chop. Because the first touch, actually, with his head, took the ball away from goal. He was already clear on goal because Trent Alexander-Arnold was on the wrong side of him. But then that took him away from him. And then I think the intelligence for him to do that chop with his wrong foot as well, the left foot, and then to finish it the way he did at that pace, I think it's just wonderful.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I don't know Trent Alexander-Arnold, but I know somebody who does. And from what they tell me, he's going to watch this and he's going to learn this.
I'm
and
sure.
He's never going to do this ever. He's not going to be fooled ever again, because he's got the pace, he's got the athleticism,
exactly,
he's got the intelligence to match up to Rashford. Also, just as a fan, how cool is it that we might get to see Rashford versus Trent Alexander-Arnold for like the next 10 years? All right, our debate this week, we're going to be talking West Ham, as we saw some scenes that I don't remember seeing in the Premier League era. But basically, at the Olympic Stadium, we saw several pitch invasions. We saw a bunch of supporters going and haranguing two of the owners, David Gold and David Sullivan, or the two main owners, I guess. Both had to leave the stadium for their own safety. We're joined by James Jones, who is the founder of the West Ham World website and who was there. James, before we get into sort of what happened, can you give us a little bit of background on what the situation is with the supporters and what the feeling is, why some supporters seem to be so angry with Gold and Sullivan, while others, weirdly, seem to be okay with them.
Yeah, I mean, it all stems back from the decision to leave Upton Park, essentially. I mean, it was a big decision to make. And when they put that forward to the fans, they were kind of selling us the dream a little bit. You know, they were going, we're going to move into this 50, 60,000 seat stadium. You know, it's going to be, you know, one of the best stadiums in Europe. We're going to start challenging for Europe. We're going to attract all these great players. And, you know, and then we had that really great final season at Upton Park where we were still very, very close to finishing the top four that season. So we were kind of sport, and then everyone, on the back of all the promises that were made by the board and everything that was said in the media about us trying to sign Batshuayi and Lacazette, everyone was really excited. And then we've moved to the stadium, we've left our spiritual home behind in Upton Park, and it's gone the complete opposite to what the owners had promised us. Not least, the stadium isn't football ready. It's an impressive stadium, but that is not a football stadium.
Did they pledge that they would? I mean, I imagine it's quite a complicated contract that they signed
yes.
for the stadium. Was part of it, was there a pledge on their part that, or maybe on the stadium owner's part, that they were going to redevelop the stadium to make it more football friendly?
Well, I think they were restricted in a sense that I mean, when they signed the contract, they were told that they'd get, you know, the football would take precedent over everything else, but they've still said that there would be restrictions because the stadium owners still wanted to use it for concerts, athletics, and everything else in between. So although they said, you know, it will predominantly be a football stadium, given that it's going to be used for other things as well, there were always going to be restrictions in that. It was made clear very early on before they even signed the agreement, as far as I'm aware, that was going to be the case. And it was never going to be purely West Ham's home and just used to football. So although they said it's going to be this fantastic football stadium, the reality is that it was never going to be that way. Everything that you saw on Saturday was a build-up of just a load of broken promises, going from the stadium move to investment in the playing squad and everything else in between. It's just everything's just bubbled over and then culminated in, unfortunately, what you saw on Saturday.
A part of me kind of feels like saying, it's Golden Sullivan and Karen Brady, what do you expect? What prompted you to believe these people, given their track record, given who they are?
I know a lot of fans didn't believe them. But, you know, on the back of that really great... I mean, I know we'd agreed the move well before Slaven Bilic arrived and had that good season, but the general feeling amongst the club was good. You know, we were looking up, we were ambitious, we were doing okay in the league. And everyone thought, you know, it's time the club tried to move forward and tried to maybe push that boundary, try and get into the top six consistently. And the new stadium comes along and it's, you know, looks like a great deal. And, you know, as I said, they've given us all these promises. And you do buy into that as a football fan. You want to see a football club do better than it is, regardless of whether it's at the top or the bottom. So although there was always scepticism, everyone was a little bit sceptical how it would work and how long it would take to really, really happen. I think a lot of fans really thought deep down that this was going to be a good move for us.
One of the things I'm struck by, and there was the piece in the Independent last week that I read, but it seems that there's a split among the fans as well. It was quite an extraordinary story. There's one group of fans that there was supposed to be a march ahead of this game, and this game, by the way, also coinciding with the 25th anniversary of Bobby Moore's passing. Then the march was called off. There's accusations between different groups. One group, which I thought was kind of extraordinary, is am I right? And correct me if I'm wrong. I don't want to slander anybody. Run by former members of the Inner City Firm, who are now all in their 50s. What's the deal there? Why is the fan base so fractured? Because we're used to seeing it on the continent. Different fan groups sometimes arguing with each other. Certainly, Julien at Paris Saint-Germain, you have a whole history of that. But it's not something you normally see in England. Is that a West Ham thing? Or can you tell us more about what's going on?
It's never been that way, or at least never been this bad. The fans are split because one group of fans are absolutely not taking any of what's happening at the moment. They're really against the board. They've had enough. They've left Upton Park. We're going backwards. Another group of fans are like, yeah, okay, that's bad and the owners deserve a lot of criticism for that, but it's never going to happen overnight. Let's give them a little bit more time. And ultimately, what happens there is you get two sets of fans clashing over different opinions, and unfortunately, has got quite nasty. And, you know, then you've got this march that was planned, which is fine. Every fan, all fans have their right to protest and to march and to have their say, particularly in times like these. But the way it was planned and the way it was suddenly cancelled and then everything that came out afterwards about the board, you know, potentially or allegedly paying off members of the Intercity firm as a result, it's further split the fans now because, you know, some fans are going, can't believe the pub did that, and other fans are going, well, I'm glad that happened because the ICF were involved. You know what I mean? So it's what's happened.
Can you just sorry, for people who don't know, can you tell people what the ICF was or is?
The hooligan group from the 80s, obviously when hooliganism was a big problem in English football, and they were the West Ham's group of, you know, they were the firm that ran that side of West Ham's hooligan culture, the only way I can really put it.
And there's an allegation that made by what other fans, which has been denied, that
there was an allegation that it was members of or previous members of the ICF that were leading this march as part of a group called the Real West Ham Fans Action Group. And they achieved their ultimate goal, which was to have a sit down with Karen Brady and the co-owners of the club to put their points across. And then suddenly they just announced the cancellation of the march very, very quickly afterwards without informing the other fan groups that were involved in these discussions. And then it was alleged that the club had paid these guys off. Mm-hmm. And then these guys were accused of then threatening other people who still wanted to march and saying, you're not marching. And if you do, you're going to be in trouble, sort of thing. So it's all a bit of a mess, really.
By the way, there's a video of this on YouTube. I think it's West Ham Fan TV. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's this guy Mickey and this other guy, Swallow. Mm-hmm. That's really his name. And they kind of give their side of the story. I just want to be fair about this because it gets pretty serious when you accuse people of taking money. And they strongly deny this. In terms of the people who ran onto the pitch, I'm obviously not condoning pitch invasions or whatever, but if you have a point to make, sometimes as fans, people get squeezed, they get taken for granted. Was it obvious to you, and you were there, what the two pitch invaders, the guy who took the corner flag and put in the middle of the pitch, and the first guy who was attacked by Noble, was it obvious to you what point they were trying to make?
Yeah, it was. I think it was obvious to everyone. You know, they were unhappy with everything.
They wanted to stop the game? I mean, was that the idea?
I don't think they wanted to stop the game. I just think that first goal that went in, the first goal that Burnley scored, I think that just triggered a lot of emotion and passion in these fans, and they just thought, you know, I can't take this anymore. I'm getting on the pitch. I need to make my point somehow. I weren't allowed to march earlier today. I need to have my point. I need to do something. Obviously, running on the pitch had a detrimental effect. I stand by my. I said some comments on Twitter after the game that, you know, those fans actually contributed to that scoreline in the end because, you know, it affected the players. They didn't get behind the team at 1-0. We had a chance to get back into that game, but essentially they had an effect on that final scoreline, which made matters a lot worse.
First goal is 56th minute, Ashley Barnes, and in the first half, West Ham were by far the better side. So
Yes. Who
can think, like, conceding a goal is outrageous, you know, I've had enough of this. The Lille fans have done something similar. They waited until the end and it was a draw and they still had one on the pitch, and it was worse in a way because they attacked their own players and they kicked and punched their own players, which is even more stupid. But I just don't get... I can get the protest and you're not happy. But like you said, why would you do it then, at that time, when there's still a chance that you could win, turn things around because you were the better side and win the game?
I absolutely agree with you with that. And that's the point I've been trying to make to a lot of fans ever since the game finished, was that if you're going to pitch invade, do it after the game. Do it once the result's done. There was no reason why we couldn't have got back into that game at 1-0 down. We've done it before at home this season. We come from behind and won. We come from behind and got a point against teams around us in the league. So to go and do what they did at that time was completely wrong. And, you know, the fans have as much to blame for that defeat as the players or the owners do, as far as I'm concerned. They did it completely the wrong way. And we are where we are now. You know, we've lost 3-0 at home to Berlin. We've got a huge game against Southampton coming up in a couple of weeks, which makes it a lot worse.
Dicko, I'm going to jump in a minute. I want to get you on this as well, James. Just to provide some historical context to it, we've had Trevor Brooking, and again,
younger listeners who may not know, in addition to being a very nice man and a West Ham and England legend, Trevor Brooking is director at the club. I think he's one of those people who everybody seems to like. Nobody I've ever met has had anything negative to say about him. He's come out and he said that, you know, maybe fans shouldn't come to the game if they're going to behave like this or not get behind the club. I can see where he's coming from. I think he obviously loves the club as much as anybody else alive. I'm just wondering, Dicko, and you know to Trevor probably better than any of us, is he kind of stuck here? Because should he maybe be taking a more active role in distancing himself from these owners? Is he somehow being used by them?
Well,
because I can't help but feel that if they stay up, it's going to be, you know, same poop, different year next year. Do you know what I mean?
He's in a difficult position. I heard David Moyes on the radio after the game, and he's sort of squirming, but, you know, understandably, he's asked about it, and he's got to talk about it, but squirming, because obviously desperately caught between, you know, I'm sure he's got his own frustrations with the owners. Who wouldn't? I've wrote a column when he took the job, everyone was sort of hammering Moyes for, you know, is he a good enough appointment? Well, I was saying, well, yeah, but a lot of the questions should be going at the owners, who can be a nightmare to work for. I mean, I wrote that I don't think Slaven Bilic suddenly became a bad manager. I just think he became a worn-down manager, because that club, there are so many agendas at work there. It is really hard place to work. It's made doubly hard, obviously, by the stadium. It's made worse by all the fan antipathy, some of which I understand, some of which I think is over the top. And, I mean, the whole thing, you know, and we can trace this back to the beginnings of the stadium and the colossal mess that was made by the blessed Lord Coe and Boris Johnson, you know, who made an absolute pig's, Ken Livingstone, and then Boris Johnson made it worse, but just a pig's ear of it. So, I mean, there are so many strands that come into just one awful situation. But, you know, back to your question, I think saying fans should stay away is, ultimately, if fans want to go and support, you know, go and watch their team, they should, you know, it's wrong to tell them to stay away. I do understand saying, look, we're in a mess here, we're in danger of going down, and invading the pitch is only going to make that worse. I mean, clearly, as we say, they're, if their heads, you know, if they weren't already suffering confidence issues, it's going to get a heck of a lot worse when you go 1-0 down, the game gets disrupted like that, and you're trying to wonder whether you're going to start a riot soon. So it clearly had an effect on confidence, which is shot to bits already. So it's they're in a fraught situation, and I think it's fair enough to say, look, you know, if you're going to come to the next game, you know, please don't threaten to riot.
James, I'm going to get your take on this and tell me, what's your best case scenario now? Do you see a pathway out of this situation? And please tell me something other than simply redesigning the club crest and getting the word London out, which seems to be a real sticking point with some people.
No, definitely not. I wouldn't go that far. I think what has to happen now, I mean, the relationship between the board and the fans, you can't fix it. It's gone. I think the owners now have to take a step back, maybe seek investment. And I understand as part of the deal they can't sell the stadium until a certain year in terms of the amount of profit they can take from it as part of the tenancy agreement. So they're not going to sell up anytime soon, but they can take a step back and then seek investment into the club and let someone else take the day-to-day running of the club. Because it's clear that what they're doing, rightly or wrongly, or whether it's intentional or wrong, I'm sure it isn't intentional, but it's going wrong somewhere. And I think that's what the fans want. The fans want change at board level, and they believe that having change at board level will eventually improve things on the pitch and at the stadium, and everything else will fall into place.
I have a good friend who's a big West Ham fan, and he prays. Okay, I have two good friends who are big West Ham fans, and they're praying for a Ray Winston, Paolo Di Canio led consortium. But the problem is, they're not rich enough.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Love the game? Then don't miss The Game Daily. It's your lunchtime update from football's finest writers, and it's only at thetimes.co.uk. Now, Arsenal, look, they're on the up again. They beat AC Milan in the Europa League, and they beat Watford. Now, our colleague Henry Winter, not so impressed. He points out the empty seats at the Emirates Stadium, and he calls it a play without a plot, which sounds sort of very postmodern. Dicko, is this what it is at this stage? Kind of like a bunch of meaningless games where they go and beat up other mid-table sides? Or is Henry being a little too negative?
No, I mean, I think that's where they're at, isn't it? I mean, they've obviously got the European campaign. It's just we're in classic Arsenal mode, aren't we? It doesn't get quite bad enough that sort of, well, they do a West Ham and run on the pitch and plant corner flags in the middle and riot and throw coins in people's faces. But then it's never good enough. It's not, you know, at the same time.
Dicko, whose face? He's not there.
Well, exactly. You're going to have to throw him a long way to Denver exactly. Or somewhere. Classic Arsenal, we're stuck. It's sort of never quite awful enough that you sort of think, oh, well, it's, you know, suddenly they've got a sniff of, thinking they've got a sniff of a European trophy. So is that, I mean, that would be classic Arsenal, wouldn't it? It would be sort of stuck in the agonies of sort of Wenger doing enough, certainly to convince himself that he's still got it, while half the fan base go crackers. So I suspect we're going to get more of this, you know, Arsenal suddenly producing a performance and people going, ooh, Aubameyang, he's suddenly looking like a player, and Mkhitaryan, and maybe there is a sniff of hope. And then obviously the next week they'll go to someone terrible and lose looking like they don't care. We've been here before, haven't we?
Do we have? Julian, about the Europa League campaign, now, some people look at it and say, all right, so you'll be AC Milan away, big deal. You're the sixth best team in the Premier League, and you go and you win away against the seventh best team, the team with the seventh most points. It's a bit unfair because Milan were on an incredible run, and Arsenal were coming from off of four straight defeats, right? So this is actually good. I mean, despite the negativity, you still got to go play the games. Ozil looked good. Mkhitaryan looked good. Mustafi even scored before he got hurt, and he looked okay, right?
Yeah, no.
And they also left out a bunch of guys, right, who maybe ahead of the, with a view towards third. I mean, Monreal, from what we hear, is fit, right? Koscielny wasn't there. Ramsey wasn't there. Wilshere wasn't there.
No, I think maybe good is too strong because of how bad things were. But it's better. It's better. And I think if you're an Arsenal fan right now, you should take that. You should take that. I thought they could have easily won 6-1 yesterday, you know, because there's that penalty by Troy Deeney. So Watford could have scored once, maybe twice. But Arsenal had many chances. Aubameyang could have had a hat-trick easily. You see some movement. You see players sort of learning to play with each other. Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang, obviously, you see that they've got good rest from before. But Ozil and Mkhitaryan, which it was not a given that they could play well at the same time together, considering that, you know, they've got, in many ways, similar profile. So I think there's some good things there. Maitland-Niles at right back, I thought, looked really good. So there's positive. But because you started so low before the Milan game, it's hard, but they've got Stoke at home, Southampton at home in the next two games, and then they go away to Newcastle, which obviously historically they've had a few nightmares there. They can easily get 9 points in the ninth, so that would be 4 Premier League wins in a row. It looks a bit better, but obviously it's too late for them, as they often do in the league, where they get those very good runs late in the season, and it's, you know, it's too little too late. But at least when there's a bit of positive, I think fans and people around the club should take it.
Dicko, word on Watford, because it's another season, another managerial change, but they're 10th in the table. And this despite, you know, having a run of injuries as well. This is good, right? Did you see their baby steps forward?
Well, 10th is certainly good, and it's, I guess, you know, vindicate. We sort of get hung up on managerial stability, don't we? And sort of it is seen as a good thing that you must. And Watford are one of those clubs that challenge that notion, challenge the idea that you can't just recite. You know, you either, you know, cut your losses when you think you've got someone who's not quite right, or with other managers, they basically just said, look, they've done well. They just said, we're not going to pay you what you think you deserve, or give you the control, maybe more importantly, that you want.
Or in this case, have a manager who signs a contract and then decides in October, ooh, I quite fancy going to Everton.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, and they've felt, and I think, with understandably, given the slump they went on, that De Silva had taken his eye off the ball, and that he, you know, having agitated to move, and there was certainly discussion about whether certain players were already sort of dreaming of wearing blue, and that they were going to follow him, and there was enough had gone wrong under him that they had to make a chop, and they're in terms of recruitment, I mean, they haven't got it perfect every time, have they? But they seem to be in a position now. It's not, you know, you suspect that sooner or later they're going to make a false one, and if they don't react fast enough, it's a high wire act, but they're pulling it off extremely well.
And they're even signing all those English players so that they can have an English spine too, right? Which is so important. Will Hughes will come good, right?
I like Will Hughes. Were you having a go at Will Hughes?
No, I'm not. Obviously, he's had injuries and stuff. It was just funny. I remember how, sort of, when he came up, everybody was so excited, and I genuinely actually hope he has a good run of fitness so that we can find out whether he can play as well.
I agree, because he's sort of always had a slightly sort of English sort of style to him as well, sort of cheeky little touch player. So, yes, let's hope so.
Yeah, that's what I think of when I think of English football, right? Don't you? Cheeky little touches, Julian?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
That's what I mean. He's, Julian's played with the English press team. He knows there's never been a cheeky little touch from an English
No, especially English, not you, Dicko. They're still looking for that ball, Dicko, at Wembley that you send on the Rao S or T, it was, I think.
I was aiming for OX.
Yeah.
Didn't quite make it.
All right. Enough of you guys reminiscing about your past footballing achievements. How about some quick hits instead? Chelsea dispatched Palace 2-1, but Olivier Giroud and Alvaro Morata waste several opportunities. Dicko, should this be a cause for concern? Or does it not matter because the single most difficult thing you can do is creating chances, and finishing is something that's down to happenstance and probability?
I think everything is a cause for concern when you're about to play Barcelona, isn't it? It's been part of the Chelsea problem this season, one of many. Morata's at times looked class, looked like someone who is going to be they're not the new Costa, different type of player, but be someone who's going to be leading their line very effectively for years. Other times, yeah, absolutely, he's lost his sort of bit of confidence, his way. So, I mean, going in against Barcelona, you ain't going to get many chances. You're going to have to take them.
Harry Kane goes down injured, but Hongmin Son moves up front as Spurs come from behind to pummel Bournemouth 4-1. Julian, we don't know the extent of Kane's injury. Would you like to do the irresponsible media thing of wildly speculating on how damaging it might be, bearing in mind that they travel to Stamford Bridge to play Chelsea on April Fool's Day, and that will probably tell us a lot about whether they finish top four?
Yes, it looked like a sprained ankle for Harry Kane, quite a bad one as well. It's a bit like the Neymar one for PSG a few weeks ago. It depends if the ligaments are damaged or not, but you could also have problem with your metatarsals. But basically, if it's a grade one sprained ankle, is 2 to 4 weeks, so it could be back. Looked like he would miss the Chelsea game, but grade two is 6 to 8 weeks. You know, that's a bit more serious. And then grade three, where the ligament could be damaged, maybe, like we said, a small fracture, is 12 to 24 weeks. The World Cup, by the way, is in 13 weeks. And
now you're scaring people.
No, I'm just saying,
the World Cup.
And after Chelsea, Spurs play Stoke away, okay, but then play Man City as well. So it looked like it could be missing some huge games, obviously. Yeah, but
if
also,
they avoid defeat at Chelsea, then they're in the top four, yeah, basically, right? So
yeah, but still, right, it's stressing time for Spurs fans.
Thank you, Dr. Julian Lawrence.
Pleasure.
Swansea go down to 10 men after 10 minutes and somehow turn in a heroic performance to escape with a draw against a Huddersfield side that has 80% possession. Dicko, are you impressed again with the mighty Carlos Carvajal, or are you a little bit sad and will point out that he didn't manage a single shot all game long?
I think in a circumstance you have to be impressed, don't you? I think the Carvajal appointment's great. I think it's a great story. He's been, well, effective, most importantly, as well as a
jolly too, right? He's always happy. He's always jolly and happy.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, you take over a team, but they were bottom of the league, wasn't he, when they took over? They've barely lost since. They've... and you know, needs must, and you know, you see him dance around the pitch at the end. Quite rightly, they're fighting for survival. They look like they're going to get it, and he deserves his bonus that's coming. I suspect
Carlos Carvajal may soon be named the official 2017-18 manager of the Game podcast. Everton defeat Brighton 2-0 and turn in a more than credible performance. Julian, does this mean Big Sam has them back on track, or is it that Brighton were still giddy by last week's exploits?
Brighton, 2 wins away from home this season in the league. In 15, they've scored 7, I think, in those 15 games. It's hardly a big turning point. I've got no time for Sam Allardyce. I think Everton deserve a better manager. And he said after the game that he was going to chill and watch Anton Deck on Saturday night, where he could watch all the shows from Anton Deck back to back instead of being an Everton manager. I think that'd be better.
Wow, you really don't like Big Sam, do you?
I don't have time for him at all. I just don't know what he's doing there.
Newcastle beat up Southampton in what we thought was a relegation six-pointer. Dicko, there seems to be little love for big Mauricio Pellegrino, and you can either reflect on that and why nobody seems to like this guy, even though he's generally quite polite, or you can go out and praise Rafa and the Rafa-lution, as we seem to do every single week on this podcast.
Well, given I spent Saturday with a Southampton fan who was sort of started miserable and by the end was pretty much suicidal, I'll speak about it. I mean, he said that he thought the Puel regime was one that he sort of, you know, disliked. He said this is new depths. He thinks, yeah, the lack of, I mean, most of the players he thinks have just given up. He thinks most of them think they're just going to get a move away. They don't give a stuff, and he's convinced they're going to go down. And given that he's normally an optimistic, sort of happy kind of guy, that tells you all you need to know.
Leicester City win 4-1 at West Bromwich Albion, and Alan Pardew says he just wants to see his men show some pride. Julian, Pards has won 7 of his last 54 Premier League games as manager. Why does he still have a job when everyone around him has been sacked? And as a special bonus question, if Unai Emery leaves Paris Saint-Germain and there were only 2 possible managers you could appoint, would it be Pards or would it be Big Sam?
Oh my God, I would have the players taking own charge of the dressing room. I would have no managers.
You'd pick Big Sam over Pardew, wouldn't you?
Maybe, if I'm forced to. Pardew, I mean, the only reason why he's still in this job is because Nick Hammond, who is the technical director at West Brom, is his best mate. That's why he was appointed in the first place, where he should have never been getting close to the job and to that club. I think it's a disaster. He's a disaster manager. He's a disastrous reign at West Brom as well. And it's too late now. Whatever they do, they just need to work for next season already in the Championship, get a manager in the summer that can get them out of the Championship and rebuild through the club, because it's just been a nightmare season. And they didn't help themselves by appointing Pardew. Gab, one for you. What's this story about the PAOK owner storming the pitch with a gun in Greece last night?
Yeah, so PAOK were playing AEK Athens. The gentleman's name is Savidis, I think. I only saw this over the internet. I don't have any specific knowledge of it. There's a goal that is apparently disallowed, although there's been some dispute about whether it actually has been disallowed. You can probably check for yourself whether that actually happened. It's important because AEK, obviously in the running for the Greek title. He runs onto the pitch to remonstrate with a referee, and it's a little bit like the Kuwaiti guy at the 1982 World Cup, if you're old enough to remember. There's a big to-do and arguing. But the creepy thing is that you look at the footage, and the guy has a holster with a handgun in it, okay? there's a, let me just reiterate this. There's an owner running onto the pitch to yell at the referee. Report suggests, coming from the AK manager, saying that he told the referee that, you know, referee's a dead man. A man with a gun, a real gun, apparently. I don't know what we've come to. I mean, you know, relative to what happened to Lille, I'm assuming nobody was packing heat at the time, but this is just extraordinary irresponsibility. Whatever your thoughts are on gun ownership and open carry, I think you would presumably agree that this is not responsible use of or responsible ownership of a firearm. It's funny because I tweeted this last night and it was late night, and so got a lot of responses from people in the U.S., including some gun owners who were pointing out that he was he had strapped his holster in a very bizarre way because the gun seemed to be backwards, and if he was going to reach with his, if he was left-handed, he was going to reach across. It was too far back, and right-handed, he would have been. But all this is funny to a point. It's also freaking nonsense. You do not go on to, you really shouldn't. I mean, unless you're in law enforcement, there's an argument to be made that you probably should not carry a firearm to a football match, and if you do, you certainly shouldn't run onto the pitch with it. The logical solution here, of course, is not to take his gun away, but to arm the players and the referees, obviously.
Hi there, and welcome to The Sweeper, which is the Times' fancy football tips service. I'm Charlie Scott, and I'm here with Paddy Bombear.
Hello.
And yeah, it was a weekend where lesser valued players shone. I mean, Kennedy for Newcastle was superb. He picked up 16 points with 2 goals and an assist in their win. At the top of the point scoring table, there was a bit of there were some worries, aren't there, Paddy?
Yeah, well, it's always difficult when Harry Kane hobbles off after well, less than half an hour, and Sergio Aguero is well, not expected to feature tonight for Man City either.
Exactly.
That's but, immediately a couple of big players taken out.
But there is the silver lining of the international break coming up, and City and Spurs aren't playing game week 31, so our advice is, when you put them on the bench, there's no point transferring them out before you know, particularly with Kane, the extent of that injury, there's a high chance that they'll both be back for game week 32, isn't there?
And if they're not, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang showed what he can do against Watford, scored a goal and set one up for Arsenal. He's in that price bracket. Arsenal, of course, don't have a game this week, but their fixtures look pretty tasty afterwards, and Mr. Mkhitaryan looks to be back in a bit of form as well, so that might be the way to look after the break.
What else impressed you over the weekend?
Well, Leicester were very good again. Mahrez and Vardy, and the Burnley strike force. Chris Wood and Ashley Barnes, both in the goals.
Absolutely, and Ashley Barnes was one of the few sweeper tips that actually did anything good this weekend. I'd like to apologise for those of you that have been reading for the past month or so. I've been banging the drum for Aaron Ramsey. I mean, just give up. I think he's just going to play in the Europa League, so I wouldn't buy him. I did.
So game week 31 is next. We've been looking forward to this for a few weeks. Only 8 teams in action. We'll have plenty of advice in Friday's email about which teams and which players are worth taking points hits for and which are just best to leave alone. Play it sensible there. Of course, if you're like me and you brought in Gylfi Sigurdsson this week, only for him to get a season-ending injury. While Everton have a game, then you'll be pretty upset, but hopefully you didn't do that. And we'll also be revealing our competition winner, our latest competition, which has a free 12-month subscription to The Times as the prize. That's all in Friday's email as well. To sign up for the email, just go to thetimes.co.uk/fantasyfootball. And what about our Facebook group, Johnny?
Our Facebook group, yeah, that was set up a few weeks ago, and it's quite busy on there. You can search for it on Facebook by just searching for The Sweeper, and you should be able to find it. And yeah, we're encouraging people to chuck in their lineups and any questions they have about transfers, and we'll get back to you as soon as possible on that.
That's all we've got time for today. Many thanks to my excellent guests Matt Dickinson and Julian Lawrence. How about you subscribe to our newspaper? It's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Just search The Times online. You don't just get The Times, you get The Sunday Times as well. And this season, you can access highlights of every single game in the Premier League, the Champions League, the Europa League. Track Arsenal's progress as they try to get into the Champions League through a different entryway, like United did last year. And also, of course, the FA Cup. And who doesn't love the magic of the cup? We're going to be back next Monday after the FA Cup quarterfinals. Our excellent producer Charlie Jones writes this, and you know, you want to highlight the most exciting FA Cup quarterfinal draw. That's what you generally do. It is kind of funny how everybody was sort of kept separate on this one. So yes, I suppose Leicester City against Chelsea is the pick of the FA Cup quarterfinals. Till next week, bye bye.
The game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.